At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
Welcome to Board Gamers Anonymous, the podcast of board gamers and the insane fun we have at the table together. This is Chris.
And this is Anthony.
And this is episode 496, our top 100 games of all time. Number 50 to number 41. We like to thank all our Patreon backers for helping us bring you a brand new episode. Hello, friends. Welcome back. As always, it is the latest and the greatest games of all time on this podcast. But for these special episodes, as you well know at this point, it's the top 100, Anthony.
Yeah, some of these are latest and greatest. I have one this week that is from the last 12 months.
Okay.
Yeah, it's late and great.
I have kind of one. That's pretty much it. But
Yeah. I don't know. Like, so we talk about themes, right? Uh-huh. What is your theme this week?
What is my theme this week? Good. Let me get. I'm pulling a vibe. I got my hands outstretched. Feeling a vibe coming in. I think we're looking at middleweight, mostly Euros that have punched above their weight class.
Okay.
So I think objectively, like, these games are good, but I do feel they are deserving of special note. And I think they have been getting special note, Anthony, because we're in our top 50, man. Like, this is serious times now.
Yeah. It's not the top 100 anymore. It is now the top 50.
This is what people tune in for. They're like, all right, cool. I heard 50 games, but what is your top 50? Like,
yeah. These are all the has-been, the also runs, right? What are the real games?
Yeah, these ones are the ones that have stood the test of time or did something significant, and they're more than just like your average games.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, no, I'm excited about what we're going to talk about this week. There are several games in here that have been on the list for a while, but I have a couple that are new that I really, really like. My theme this week is definitely like building. Okay. And specifically, I'd say like at least half of these are like cities or city related, which is like a theme that has been, if you go back to like the beginning of my history in gaming, especially like more mature gaming, like at a computer, at a tabletop, it is like city building. It is like construction. It's creating systems out of chaos. Like SimCity was, you know, one of the first games I played at my family PC, and I played it for hundreds and hundreds of hours. And so my board game preferences tend to reflect that, and you know, to varying degrees. And I feel like this week's list is a little bit of that.
I like it. I like that a lot.
All right.
You're taking us back, yeah, but you're bringing us forward, and a little bit of Anthony in there.
Yeah. No, it's very deep, man.
That's, I like this. See, this is the bottom 50, man. This is where things start getting real.
It's getting real. Getting real. So, we're talking real games here. Yeah, the top 50? Whatever. Don't even listen to those.
I mean, who are those games?
Did, so.
I don't even know those games. They didn't come with us. That's fine.
You know what? Actually, I take that back. If you're listening to this and you did not listen to the past five, go back and listen to those first. You know, support the show. But yeah, no, it's going to be fun. These are good games.
It's also funny, too, because when you do a top 100 list, especially in this format where we're, you know, blocks of 10. I think once we get to the end, of course, too, like always, typically everyone's like very interested in, you know, 1 to 10. But I do feel like having listened to so many other people's lists over the years, there's usually a block that's more interesting.
Mm.
You know, just uniquely interesting. Like we've been talking about vibes along the way. So maybe as you've listened to the last couple of episodes and listened to the next couple, maybe for you, there's a block that really stood out, maybe different for me or Anthony, you know, like maybe my 60 to 70 or 30 to 40, but Anthony's 20 to 30 might be really hot for you all. So that might actually be a question of the week or something, like what episode, what games kind of really worked.
Yeah. I kind of want to like have a top 10 after this of our top 10 or our 10s. What is your best 10?
Let's listen to the top 100.
Like, how meta can we get with this?
No, because I think sometimes, like, we often talk about this. Like, if you look on your shelf, like, which little cubicle or which shelf might be, like, maybe not your favorite games, but collectively,
mm-hmm.
it's better than some, you know, some of those things. And, again, how we put the list together, where we kind of, like, really drill down pretty deeply, I think it's interesting, like, why games kind of, how would you say, levitate or sink to a certain spot. Mm-hmm. And it's not like, well, I really like this type of mechanic, so therefore they're all here. That's not at all what's happening. So
no, not at all.
I think it's interesting to think of like, what's the through line for these games? And if you look at least my board game geek, how I rate games, there it's a pretty unique bell curve to it. It's skewed positively.
Right.
But that's not necessarily what you see here on the list, because sometimes you got to look at the games and be like, huh, how often would I play this? Would I get it to the table? And I think a lot of games historically that I had on my list in my top 100 did not return because right. either the player count was challenging or the game mechanics caused problems with the group.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in a real world context, even though objectively it may be better, but in actual play, it just doesn't work. And again, some of that's player count issues. And as you know, as we're in the age of the big box tabletop game, getting that to the table is a different experience than back in the day where like you used to have a board game bag that fit like 5 or 6 games in it.
Right, right.
And now it's like, one game. You could bring one game with you.
Seriously. Like, you came down and visited the other day, and we played Andromeda's Edge, which yes. is, like, the size of a small car.
It is.
And then Slay the Spire, which is, like, much more compact, but still, like, a ridiculously large box.
It is.
And, like, I stacked them on a chair in the corner, and I was like, that's a small child. I need a car seat for those games.
Yes.
I couldn't even bring both of those. Yes. Like, two games to game night is too much. I have to pick one, and that's it.
And at the end of the day, with both of those games, while they're both very good, and we'll talk about our reviews at some point, I guess after we get through the top 100, they are fundamentally a worker placement game and a co-op game.
Yeah, like, I know. Yeah,
it's not, like you said, you think of the enormity of that box and all the stuff that entails and the quality of the components and the production and everything else that goes along with, and the cost,
yeah,
the immense cost in the years that you waited for that game. And it's not radically different than the games that you already have on your shelf.
No, not at all. Yeah, no, it's crazy, you know, and it's like, I don't know. We're going back down the road of complaining about the big boxes again, but I feel like we could just have a whole podcast. It's like big boxes.
I thought that
suck.
Was a very good episode. I don't think a lot of people listen to that yet, but I think it's a very good episode.
Definitely listen to it because it's not just us complaining. That's what we're doing now, but in that episode, we really get into the nitty gritty of why it's a problem.
Yeah. So, Yeah, and it's some function, because again, if we do say something in that respect, it's because we want to get the game to the table.
Yes, yes.
And I think fundamentally, why games do not make a list, or why games don't get played as much, is because they can't get to the table for some reason.
Right.
So whether it's a giant big box, which is pretty obviously why it's not getting to the table, but sometimes other games don't get to the table because of a certain player count, or because you need a certain group, because right. a game might be more complicated, or it might have a certain IP, or it might be a certain genre. Like, this is a great game, but it's about 16th century bookmakers who, you know, sailed on the Arctic, you know, river. Just like, I don't...
Yeah. No, you're spot on. That's exactly what happens. So
a lot of things do it. So let's get to some good games, Anthony. What's your number 50?
All right. Number 50. And I already know in advance without looking at your list. This is going to be on your list later. So I'm just going to preempt you there. this is Concordia. This is Matt Gaetz's magnum opus. And Matt Gaetz has a lot of good games. But this is the one everybody knows the best. It sold the most. It has a bunch of maps. It has multiple versions. And I almost put down Concordia Venus because mm-hmm. I think it's a more interesting game. I think it's more creative and engaging. And like the team aspect, the two-player element of that is so, so, so cool.
Very much so.
But they released the Solitaria expansion for Concordia. And it's, I think, one of the better like standalone solitaire expansions for a Euro game. Like, mm-hmm. it really makes it work in an interesting, creative way. It's not just like a high score race. It's not just like a bot to play against. It really does interesting things. And so I've been playing a lot more just Concordia or the various maps of Concordia. Whereas Venus, I've played 3 or 4 times since it came out, 2018. And I would love to play it more, but you need like a group of like 4 to 6 people, and you need to be in such a group that you can sit on in groups and play. To that degree. So the core gameplay here is just, it's such a classic, you know, you have your hand of cards that you build up over time. The cards represent the actions you're going to take, but they also represent how you're going to score at the end of the game. So you're building a deck of cards based on both actions and scoring mechanisms, and you get to take those actions one at a time and then pull that hand back, you know, up into your hand when you're ready to do so. You could teach the rules of this game in a good 5 to 10 minutes. It's very straightforward. Everything is on the map. And it's, you know, it looks at first glance like it should not be that engaged. It shouldn't work that well. It's almost too simple. And yet it's, the complexity is emergent, right? It comes out of the game as you play through it. Balancing out your resources, trying to make sure you have enough space for everything, you know, building up the things you need to be able to accomplish the things you're trying to accomplish. It's such a clever, creative game, and I have a blast with it every time I play it. So I have too many maps for this game. I don't play all of them, although gotten through most now with the Solitaria expansion. But yeah, Concordia, it's like a game that like snuck up on me over the years. Like, the first few times I played it, I'm like, this is fine. And then eventually I'm like, actually, this is great. And now I'm like, actually, it's genius. This is a great game. So Concordia.
As you said, Anthony, and you predicted quite well, it is higher on my list, but let me just say one thing, because we don't mention Matt Gaetz enough, and his Concordia series certainly, but his other games as well, as Rondell's series of games.
Yeah,
we've played if not all of them, a lot of them, right. And the man is a straight out genius. Like, we do not say his name enough, and we really should. And I think he just went full-fledged Concordia, and we've been enjoying that ride. But there's been a lot of other great games that people should stop and take a look at.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very possible we'll talk about them again in a couple weeks.
Ooh, exciting.
I know.
Foreshadowing, folks. That was foreshadowing.
Yes.
Anthony's the writer. He's doing the thing. All right. My number 50 is a game Anthony talked about, but it's higher on my list because I have better taste. It's At the Gates of Luoyang from 2009. It's this man, the myth, the legend, that is Uwe Rosenberg from Tasty Minstrel Games, way back when Tasty Minstrel Games was a game company. At the Gates of Luoyang was a game that I remember playing for the first time at a tabletop convention and just going, oh, this seems like a smaller game. you're just producing all these wonderful vegetables and selling them in the market, and I can do that, and then wham! Just like, you were not thinking about one or two little small things, because, you know, when you play this game with four players, there's very unique interactions between the players as far as the cards are concerned, and you take that bump home with you, and you think about that, and you come back, and you're like, look, there's something about harvesting crops and fulfilling orders that Uwe Rosenberg knows so well, and there's something about at the gates of Loyang that's just, it's right there, right in front of you, what you have to do, how you have to harvest the vegetables, how you kind of manipulate the markets, how you bring in different people to help you produce and sell out there to the field, how you must, even at the very start of the game, you must be in a position to pay to move up the victory point track, because you will get left behind quite quickly, and it's very hard to catch up. But it is certainly one of the most dynamic, interesting games from Uwe Rosenberg. We talked about Matt Gertz for a second. This game, it does not get enough love, does not get enough attention, and it's my favorite solo game from Uwe Rosenberg. It might in fact be my favorite solo game of all time, just because it's just streamlined. Like, it's such a beautiful version of his games. And again, he has so many big games that I think people forget about his smaller games. This is brilliant. It's brilliant, it's sharp, it's fun, and the variety of workers that you can pull in to be able to utilize their special abilities keeps up the variety of the game going. Good production, decent artwork, decent graphic design. Again, please take an opportunity to play at the Gates of Loyang.
It is great. Yes, I fully agree with that. I talked about this one, well, when was that? Like 3 weeks ago? It was up there. But yeah, it's a fantastic game. And it really is like the solo element, and like the fact that it's so tight, it's not like a traditional worker placement type of game from Uwe. It's so great.
Absolutely.
All right. Number 49 for me is a trick-taking game.
Ooh.
My second, maybe even third on this list. I don't remember if I have a third one on there or not. This is Skull King. I discovered this with my group of friends back in Pittsburgh, and I really like quadrupled down on it with my family. So I brought this game with us on a camping trip in 2020 when we had to cancel our vacation plans and go on a quiet camping trip into the woods because of COVID. And my kids fell in love with it, which, if you have kids, you know, means we played it about 6,000 times after that. So it is a trick-taking game in a fairly traditional sense. You have various suits and they're numbered up to 14. You have a Trump suit with the flags, and you have like super Trumps beyond that with the pirates, and then a variety of different suits that kind of trump each other in different ways. So, you know, the pirates beat everything, except the Skull King beats the pirates, except the siren beats the Skull King, so on and so forth. There are white flags that allow you to lose a hand automatically, unless everybody plays a white flag and then you win the hand, which I always find funny. And then there's even more advanced cards that go beyond that, like the Kraken will destroy the hand. There's a lot of cool, interesting things to do here. What really makes the game interesting to me is that each hand in the game has 10 rounds is escalating in the number of cards that you have. So the first hand of the game, you have one card and you're bidding, because it's a pirate game. You have to be bidding, right? So you might draw in your first hand a pirate card, and you're like, I have a 95% chance of winning this hand. I'm going to bid. I think I'm going to win. And then someone has a Skull King. You're like, gosh darn it. There's no way to prepare for that. So like, you play the odds, you work the cards as best you can. You can manipulate it and think really cleverly and be strategic. But at the end of the day, it's still the card game. There's some luck to it.
Mm-hmm.
I love trick-taking games with bidding in them. I love trick-taking games where you can't count out the cards. This has both of those things. It is a perfect, like, just relaxed atmosphere type of game. But at the same time, people get really into it. Despite playing this game 6,000 times with the kids, I still love it. It's my favorite trick-taking game, period.
Wow.
And they keep releasing new versions. So, you know, track it down. Skull King, one of the all-timers. It's my number 49.
That's very high praise from you.
Yeah, it's so good. It's silly and fun, and it's, you know, Cat in the Box is very clever and creative and does some interesting things, But this one is just like, I don't know, it's doing what a trick-taking game is meant to do, and everybody's having a good time and yelling at each other, which is great.
Yeah, we played this together. And yep. Again, you went from like not wanting to be anywhere near a trick-taking game to like fully embracing them and becoming the trick-taking guy.
Yeah, it's, I guess the first few I played were bad. So, and a bad trick-taking game is a very bad game. It's like a bad area control game where, like, if it's poorly made, you're not doing anything, and that is a bad experience. If it's well made, you're always doing something, even if you're not winning. And that's all I want in a game. I don't care if I win. I just want to be doing something, right? I want to accomplish something. I have my own little mini game if I can. Sure. So a game where you just like lose repeatedly and it has nothing to do with anything other than you drew a bad hand, I'm like, this is not fun. which is why Skull King is so fun, because you can draw a terrible hand, you bid zero, and you try to lose every hand, and that's fun. especially if you pull it off and you score a bunch of points and everybody gets mad at you. No, it's great.
Excellent. My number 49 is Cuba. Cuba is a game from 2007. It's about the pre-revolution market and people of the island and how they are able to grow their agriculture, produce a number of fine products to go to the market, be able to sell to their community and also sell offshore, while at the same time utilizing and benefiting from Parliament and providing some political influence to benefit the people of Cuba. So this was a game that just kind of out of nowhere, like I never had heard anything about it. I don't think it got much press. And it's a beautiful production of the island and of the different major cities and markets. And then you have your own individual player board, which has the different opportunities to grow these different resources, and as you're growing them and as you're producing more advanced resources to go to the market has a lot of really cool dynamic actions to it. On top of all of that, there's action cards that let you utilize different people of the island to be able to support you from building buildings on these lands that give you special abilities and actions, especially how they're kind of positioned on the player board, and also laws that come up for votes. These laws affect everything that happens in the game. Some of them are beneficial to you or maybe beneficial to others or negative to a lot of different people there. So this is a game, again, did not get much attention. I've been championing this game for a long time. This certainly would benefit from a reprint. The expansion's great for it because it allows you to do a lot of different things with the political system. It has more of that kind of political challenge in there. So Cuba. Game from 2007 that is still in my collection and still gets gameplay.
You've talked about this game enough that I'm just like, how have I not played this yet?
It's true.
I don't like it. You describe it. I'm like, that sounds like a lot of fun, and yeah, we're good friends. How have I not played this game?
It's true. Keep playing the hotness. It's always the hotness, man.
It is. Yeah. Like one of these years, we're just going to have to be like, no hotness this year. We're just going to the stuff, and all we're doing is playing games the other one hasn't played.
We'll have to go through our top 100s and be like, have you played this? Have you played that? We got to play this. We got to play that.
Right, yeah. It's been 10 years of us talking about this game and the other person being like, oh, I haven't played that. And yeah, all the listeners are like, play it then.
Play the games.
It's like, they're good.
We can't see past the giant boxes.
Yeah, they're everywhere.
It's true.
Oh, man. All right. Number 48 for me is a game that I only picked up because it was super cheap and I recognized the name of the designer from a game that was earlier on my list, Arkwright. This is Gentis, which I think is how you say it. Is that how we say it?
It's somewhere around that area.
Part of me wants to like put a huh in there, but
it does.
I think it's Gentis. So this is a civilization building game from Stefan Risthaus, again, who designed Arkwright.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a interesting spin on civilization because it's ancient civilization.
Yes.
Right? It's like the tree of civilization, like early. So you're not like building up armies and attacking each other and having a tech tree. You're like very early on in civilization and spreading out through the Mediterranean, right? Like early cradle of civilization development, right? What makes the game so interesting though is not the setting necessarily, but the mechanics of it, where you have one of the core resources of the game is time, right? Because you are passing time. And it reminds me of playing games like Civilization, where on a given round, you can only do so much and then time passes. And eventually you run out of time and everything's going to take off into space. Have you done everything you want to do? This game doesn't have that kind of scale, but it has that kind of feel of like you have a limited space of time, a limited resource of time. You got to use it. And I really find that fascinating. Like the first time I played it, I'm like, that's a clever thing. The second time I played it, I was like, that's a clever and fun thing. And now that I've played it a few times, I could see really like the genius behind the game. It's just doing something that no other game has done with the Civilization genre. Now, is it the prettiest thing in the world? No. There isn't deluxified version that Tasty Minstrel released down the line after the Spielworks edition. I did track down a copy of that. I do have it. It is better. It's still not like the prettiest thing in the world.
Yes.
But it has that kind of old Greco-Roman look and feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
It almost looks like a Rio Grande board. Like it's just got like the kind of pastel-y greens and yellows.
It does. Yeah, true.
And like very simplistic kind of stenciled artwork. I love the vibe of it, but it's like you lay it out on the table. It almost looks like a splatter game.
It's true. Yeah, good call.
But all of that aside, like mechanically, like the puzzle here of like managing time, trying to build out your civilization, take advantage of the resources that are available in the locations that, you know, it does so many cool things in a way that's so unique within the space. And this is one of my favorite genres of game that it's just, it's climbed its way onto my obviously top 50 now as just a unique, engaging spin on civilization building that I, again, haven't played anything like it. There's a new version of this or re-implementation of this called Epos that was on GameFound recently. I ended up deciding not to back that because it's longer. And I feel like Gentis is the perfect length. I have a lot of Civ games that are like 3-4 hours long and I love them. This game is like 90 minutes to 2 hours. And I think that's perfect for what it is. Like it feels complete and it builds and it concludes in the time that you give to it. And it is still relatively easy to find. Like I don't know that it's necessarily in print because the publishers of it are no longer around, but they made a lot of copies. So like they're out there. If you want a copy, it's pretty easy to find. But yeah, Gentis, good game.
I remember seeing this up on crowdfunding and just really struggling. We probably talked about this on an episode way back when.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And the name is a little bit of a challenge too, of course, but the production, I remember looking at the page and just trying to go, what am I doing here? Because like you mentioned, as a Civ game goes, you have certain expectations of what should be here, right? This should be a 4X on some level. And they're like, no, it's about time. And you're like, huh? You're like, yes, time.
Yeah. You get hundreds of these little hourglass tokens, which I love. I love the hourglass tokens.
And I remember that I went to a game day at a friend's house and they were like, this? And I'm just like, oh no, dear God. Like you said, it looks like a splatter game. It looks like something that came out 30 years ago and was forgotten. And it has the little Catan houses and the little cubes. And I was just like, oh no. I was like, I remember this. And I remember just like, and I played it and I absolutely loved and adored it on my first play.
Yeah.
And I was just like, and it really comes down to the mechanics. And the art style, while not my cup of tea, is I wouldn't say even just quite appropriate. It's absolutely appropriate.
It's
really
perfect. Yeah.
It fits the theme. It fits the vibe 100%. And I just like, then, you know, when you play a game and you're just like, I could have backed this. And you just start kicking yourself.
Yeah.
I absolutely did that. And I was thrilled to pick up a base copy, like the, you know, like the cheaper production copy. And I never forgot my later experiences with the deluxe version, which, and again, all these things are very arguable, but I'm going to argue it. I think the deluxe version of it is just more playable.
Yeah.
And I think since this production's already very simplistic and streamlined and almost like archaic, I think you do need the deluxe version. And I haven't had the heart to open up the base retail version of my copy just because I'm just like, I just want to play the deluxe version of this. Like, why did I even bother? It's like, I like this game. I'm like, I need the deluxe version of this. So
yeah,
this would have certainly made my list if I didn't have to like emotionally distance myself from the game.
Yeah.
Because I did in the couple of plays I did have it, and I think we did review it way back when. I enjoyed it tremendously. I just, the retail version just didn't do it for me, and I have a copy of it and I'll keep it until one day the deluxe version just appears, you know, briefly in a vision.
Yeah. Well, thankfully they printed a lot of copies of that thing. I think I got my copy on eBay for like $60 and okay. It came with the insert. Like was, it's not like Orleans, like
yeah.
The deluxified version of that is stupidly expensive, but you can find this one. And I will say one last thing, the cover art, like the board work is like whatever, but the cover art, that tree, love that picture. I would put a poster of that on my wall.
Like, sure.
Just that Tree of Civilization look. It's great.
I 100% agree. And again, for us here in the US, like Tasty Minstrel Games, like there's some problems. There was some problems with them. Again, we've talked about that in the past, but like they really picked out some really sweet games over the years. And I was sorry to see them go. So yeah, this was definitely one of them. All right. For me, my number 48 is what I think we can kind of classify as a modern day classic. Kingsburg, way back from 2007, or you could pick up the second edition in 2017. Kingsburg was one, one of the early games that I just like, this is my game. This is what I play. This is what I bring to game night.
Mm-hmm.
Kingsburg is really interesting and brilliant because mainly you have a large player board where everyone plays on the same board. And on the board is basically all these worker placement spots. But you have your, you know, you are one of the people that is in charge of your province, and you're trying to grow your province. You're trying to protect your border from all these invaders. So you're utilizing your assistants and your advisors out there to roll dice, and you send your assistants out, and based upon you rolling your dice, that shows you the power of your influence in which you can play onto that main board, which is a huge cast of characters in that kingdom, from the king and queen all the way down to the Joker. So based on the pips, the higher pips that you put out onto the board, the more powerful the action will be. But you don't necessarily need the most powerful action. You need the three resources to build the buildings that build up your province to be able to, you know, provide you with your victory points, provide you with your defenses against the incoming horde, and it lets you pick different advisors throughout the game. So it was that very early, interesting idea of that dice rolling could be about something else. And it allowed us to kind of jockey for position, but have an opportunity to like really build your own particular strategy, because then your own specific player board had all of these different buildings that gave you a vast variety of different special abilities and resources, and you got to decide what types of buildings you were going to build across those columns and rows to add to your kingdom. Sometimes it gave you upgrades and support, sometimes it gave you defense, sometimes it let you see what was coming up. Everyone got to do something different. At the end of the game, you had this beautiful tableau of which buildings you were able to put together. You dealt with some unknown actions that were happening on the game board. And it was just such a simple, streamlined, straightforward kind of game that even to today, I still bring this game out. I have the expansion for the original one, which makes it great, but the second edition, don't love the artwork as much, but the second edition has all of the stuff that goes along with it, including the expansion and the other expansions, which are like global effects and special characters to give you asymmetrical special abilities and things like that. So Kingsburg, a really good solid gateway game for a lot of gamers out there.
It is great. Yeah, it's one of those games, like, for the longest time, I was trying to find a copy just because it was so hard to find, like you said. So it's a fantastic, easy to play game in those like tight time periods mm-hmm. of like, let's play something interesting and clever that's not going to take 4 hours. And this is like a perfect, like you mentioned at the start, like that midweight Euro.
It is. And it's one of those games where you could just put it on the table because it has the diagram of the flow of the actions.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't even have to read the rules. You get your dice, you get your personal boards, you get that main player interaction board that everyone works off of. And you just go through the steps and it's fun. So plays quite well.
Great. All right. Next up for me is a game that I wasn't sure how to list it on the top 100. And I'll tell you why. So I mentioned I love city building. I love kind of the flow of it, of expanding and creating this wonderful thing. And the game that like most represents that, like that love I had for SimCity when I was a kid in board game format is Suburbia. Now, I don't have Suburbia from 2012 anymore. I have Suburbia Collector's Edition from 2019. I have not actually played my copy of Suburbia Collector's Edition from 2019 because the box is stupidly big and hard to carry around, and there's so much stuff in there that it's hard to like pull it out. I played other people's copies. Great production, but it's you know, we've complained about this enough. Like, big boxes are dumb. But before that, the copy I had originally, which I passed on to a friend when I got this one, I played all the time. And I've played the app a million times. And it's a wonderful, clever, creative experience from Ted Allspach, where you have a market of cards, and you're purchasing those and adding them to your tableau. And that tableau is going to build out like a grid, and all these different tiles are going to interact with each other and cause different things to happen. Like there's a lot of tracking, there's a lot to keep your eyes on, but if you can keep your eyes on it, if it really like clicks in your head, like managing that flow between population and income and everything else is just such a fun experience. This board game feels like what it felt like to play SimCity. Is it SimCity? No, gosh, no. But it feels like what it felt like to play that game, you know, 30 years ago in my case. And it's for that reason alone, like the first time I played this game, way back when 2013, when we were first getting into this and starting the podcast, I was like, this is amazing. This is perfect. I love this. And it's really just been up there for me ever since. It has dropped in my rankings. It was as high as like number 10, I think at one point. And I can fully blame the collector's edition for being this big, stupid box that I can't carry anywhere. And it takes too long to set up. But, you know, if I really wanted to get it out, of course I could. I own it. But when it comes to city builders, when it comes to a game that, like, replicates that feeling of taking all these resources, building up the commercial and the industrial, and having all these resources there, nothing really does it like Suburbia. It's still that game, especially with the expansion content, which is all in there. It's an all-timer. So, officially, it's listed as Suburbia Collector's Edition. That's what I have. That's the best production of the game. But, you know, if you find the original, by all means, pick it up. It's easier to get set up and played. So,
I agree with you so much. This is higher on my list.
What?
I know. Surprise. Plot twist. I do want you to break this out so that I can pick what color green I want to play as.
Yes, let's do it. Then I can say I played it, and the next time I can stop complaining about it.
And we talked to a friend of ours, Carmen, who has the same problem. He's like, I need to get rid of this. And he's like, I don't want to get rid of it. It's a really good game, but I need to get rid of this because I never play it because it's so big. I was like,
I'm almost tempted to contact my friend back in Pittsburgh and be like, you want to trade? Like, I'll take back my old copy with all the expansions in the small box. You take this big, stupid box. Like, then I'll play it more often.
It breaks your heart. It really does.
Mm-hmm.
I will say one thing. It's a city builder. It's kind of SimCity, as you mentioned. But they never threw in anything weird into the game. There was no Godzilla.
Yeah.
No zombies. No volcanoes exploding. You would think, right?
Yeah, it's a weird thing. Like, the first expansion for Small City has Godzilla.
Yes.
Like, Alvin VR went right for it. He's like, you gotta have Godzilla. That's number one.
Yeah. He's like, of course, Godzilla.
Winter expansion, module one, Godzilla.
Yeah.
There are 40 modules for this game. Number one, Godzilla.
Yeah.
But yeah, Suburbia didn't really do it. Like, and the weather, weather is huge. Earthquakes, disasters.
They never did that. I can't imagine. I mean, it seemed like it would be the most straightforward, simple thing to do. Throw some a deck of global effect cards.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. It feels like you just kind of, like, once this Kickstarter was out, they're like, we're done with it. We're not doing this anymore.
Sure.
It's been 5 years. They haven't touched it. So.
Hmm. Ted, call me up. I got some ideas for you.
Yeah.
They may be kaiju related, more or less.
It can be a giant werewolf if you want, man. It's fine. Or like that big black cat from Cat in the Box.
See, you can use your own IP stuff. It doesn't need to be Godzilla.
Synergy or something.
Yeah. I don't like that. It's fine. It could be a werewolf mode to it. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do. You flip the tiles over. It's nighttime. I don't know. We met Ted Alsbeck. He's a great guy. We talked to him. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's been a while, but yeah. So that's pretty fun. All right.
Yeah.
Speaking of people who we've spoken to in the past, my number 47 is Quantum for 2013. Anthony, you might know this gentleman. His name is Eric Zimmerman.
What? He's in our journal.
I know. He did a thing for us because the man is like all kinds of like tabletop board game intelligence. He's just a scholar of scholars there. And it turns out way back in the day before I met the man and before he wrote anything for us, he made a board game, man. Like that was the thing that actually happened. Oh yeah.
Yeah. No,
a very good one. And it's something that I backed way back in the day. And this was, again, he's known for his metagames. Very interesting. Take a look at it. But this was like his board game. This was a thing. And I guess there's the obvious thing to say. If again, it's super out of print at this point. When initially it came out, there was some problems with the dice. They were sticky. And that was kind of weird because they were different colored dice. And you were like, I'm not really too sure about this. This was produced by Funforge, which are we mentioning that Funforge having some problems? Got bored a little bit.
Yeah. They're probably done. They sold off to Kaido.
Yeah. Which is like their game. Like that's their thing.
If you're
thing.
Selling off the big one, you're pretty much done.
Yeah. That's the thing that they do. And they went ahead and did it. So the fun thing about, and I just talked about Kingsburg again, back in the day where dice were really interestingly used. So for Quantum, you had your epic space 4X game. You had fighting, you had exploration, you had area control and grid movement and a modular board and all that kind of fun stuff. And you did it with really big, chunky, beautifully colored dice. So the really fun part of it is the different pips on the dice, so for 1 through 6, represented a different class of ship. And as you went through the game, you could upgrade your ships. You could put different ships out on the board. And what those ships did were different from each other. They had like legitimately different roles. They weren't just stronger than other ships. They did different things. And you needed all the ships to go out there. You win the game by constructing these quantum cubes. And basically these kind of like energy, extractors that they pull from these different planetary systems. It is you're running out across the board to get to these spots to be able to utilize resources in order to be able to, you know, create your like basically area control, put your little cubes out there on the board. And it's small enough that there was a lot of interesting gameplay and tactics that went on to maneuver around people or through people or actually to attack other players. A lot of attacking help happened in this game. And they also gave you these white and black technologies and special features and allies that came along with the game that gave you different ways to play, gave you different special abilities for your particular faction. And the module board was a lot of fun because you could actually set up what kind of game mode you were looking at. And it really scaled very well based on the number of players. Actually, the book itself gave you different ways to set up the board, different encounters to have. One of my favorite games. And again, I still have a copy of it, still enjoy it a great deal. Haven't gotten it to the table too much, but again, it's something that will always play very well because of all the thought that goes into that. That's Quantum.
Yeah, this is a game I wish I'd bought back in the day. Like, it was very cheap for a short amount of time post Kickstarter. And now it's not cheap at all. Very, very expensive. I love this game. I had a lot of fun with it, but I have not played it much outside of Board Game Arena in like the last 10 years because I don't have a copy, never found a copy, and not willing to pay like $250 for another copy. But I do love it. I feel like if I owned one and I played it more often, it would probably be on my list as well.
Sure. Well, I know a guy who can make it help, maybe help you with that.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. Well, yeah, that's right. Hey, man, you got any extra in your basement? Hook us up.
Yeah. Well, he blew up after he hit our journal, I'm just saying.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's big now.
That made him.
Okay. Another game that's hard to find and very expensive. We're killing it here. So if you want the games we're talking about, good luck. This is not my number 46, Leaving Earth.
Mm.
This is a self-published game from Joseph Fatula. Came out in 2015. This is not a game that was on Kickstarter. It was never crowdfunded that I'm aware of. It was just self-published on Fatula's website, the Luminaris Group. And it literally comes in what is essentially a small shoebox. But a very well-designed shoebox with a fancy little cover on it. Beautiful artwork, very art deco, wonderful space stuff. Like, it's one of my favorite like approaches to that kind of 60s, 70s space race kind of aesthetic. And the game is quite literally about that. It starts in 1956. It's the start of the space age. No one's actually got anything up there yet, and you are trying to be the first one up there. It very, very much leans into the science and math of the space race, though. It's a very mathematically heavy game, to the point where if you go to BGG, it's a 1-5 player game, and the community recommends that you play it at 1, because if you play with multiple people, it gets very crunchy and time consuming. It drags quite a bit. Like, playing solo, I can play it in like 90 minutes or so. I feel like if I play with the full 5 players, it could take hours. So I've never done that. I don't think I would ever want to. But the game is great because it's all card-based. You lay these cards out, and they create kind of the map of what you're going to go for. So, like, if you go set, like, if you look at the map on BoardGameGeek, you can see, like, the cards laid out, like, these little square cards that create, like, the Earth where you're trying to escape gravity, and, like, the moon where you're trying to get your rockets to. And then as you develop further beyond that, not just the moon, you're trying to get to Venus and Mercury and Mars. And you're not just launching rockets, you are testing those rockets, right? So when you develop the technology that you need to go off into space, you have to test it. And the more you test it, the more sure you're going to be that it's successful when you finally launch. But you use up time when you do that. So if you test too much, then your opponent might beat you, right? It's a space race. So it's all about risk management. It's a bit of a push your luck game, but with a ton of math built around it, which is such a good simulation of what the space race was, right? You wanted to be safe, especially after like Apollo 1. You want to be really safe. You don't want people to die, but you really got to push the envelope a little bit because you want to win that race. You want to get up there first. And the game really captures that really extremely well, right? This has been one of my favorite games pretty much since it came out. I don't remember when I got my copy, like 2016, 2017. There are expansions for this as well that are even more expensive. The version I have came with the Mercury expansion. There's an Outer Planets expansion, which is like near future sci-fi where you're going, you know, past the asteroid belt out to Jupiter. But it, even the base game, even just like that simple puzzle, not simple, very complex puzzle at the beginning, just getting that rocket off of Earth, it is legit like a simulation of trying to make the Saturn V work. Right, it's such a cool, fun, creative, crunchy experience. You gotta like math. You probably gotta like sci-fi, not even sci-fi, like space racy stuff. But I've been obsessed with that stuff since I was like 6 years old. So, Leaving Earth, fantastic little game. There's copies still floating around out there. I don't know if they still sell this on their website. Like when I bought it back in the day, I just bought it off of their website, and I had to wait like 3 months because they're, you know, self-made. But it, even if you can't get it through there, you can track it down on eBay for a lot, but it's still out there. So Leaving Earth, great stuff.
Fantastic. Since this is a shoebox game, we can play this. We should play this.
Yeah. Yeah. This, I can carry this with me. I carried it in my hand. I went on a short trip a few weeks ago and I just carried it in my hand on the train. Cause it's very small. It's all cards.
Have not played it. Yeah, no, this is great now. I want to play this now.
Yeah, we should play this. Yeah, I love this game. This is fantastic.
Excellent. All right. Going back to the list here, my number 46 is St. Petersburg, the second edition. First edition does well, but I like the second edition because it adds a market phase to the game. But let me take a step back and tell you why St. Petersburg, either the first edition or second edition, is so great. You got to go back to 1703. Caesar, Peter the Great, is founding St. Petersburg in Russia. And all of these different royals, artisans, construction workers, farmers, all the different aspects of that particular civilization are coming together to build St. Petersburg. At the start of the game, you're given one of these odd little shaped wooden tokens. This shows you during which round you're the first player to be able to select. Each round, you are selecting from one of five different possible selections of cards. So the first round's typically your farmers, your shipbuilders, the people that are the foundation of the city. And they come out in the market and you're able to purchase those cards to put them into your tableau. And then throughout the game, they're generating resources for you. A little bit later on, again, depending on which version you play, there's a market phase. A little bit later on, there's a building phase. These beautiful, wonderful buildings in St. Petersburg, these wonderful architects, artisans, engineers, and workers, you'll be able to select those buildings for victory points. Sometimes they have some money that they'll be able to support you with a little bit, and there's some interesting kind of buildings that like you can build early and then build atop them later. Some observatories that give you some special abilities, but primarily this is your victory point buildings that hopefully during the green phase, they've been able to give you enough money to purchase the blue buildings later on. Then comes the nobles. The nobles come in. They're rather interesting because these are going to give you a variety of money and victory points, but really it's a set collection. You want to get different nobles to your court. At the end of the game, they're going to score you the bulk of your victory points. You don't need them to win, but certainly it's a strategy. And then finally, there's a special deck that has a little bit of everything. And really, these special cards at the end are upgrade cards for the other cards in your tableau. You can hold some cards in your hand, but at some point they become problematic because if you don't get them out at the end of the game, they're negative victory points. This was one of the first kind of really dynamic tableau building market kind of experiences that I really, really enjoyed and locked into. It seemed too big. It seemed too heavy. It seemed too crunchy. But because it played through very intelligently, like this, you know, you're building the foundation, you need those resources. Great. Now you're building those buildings for those people. They're building up those buildings. Now you have these buildings, like they're the pride of the city. Okay, now the nobles come into those buildings and they're giving you a lot of benefits and resources. And now you can upgrade those things. And everybody's jockeying for different positions. There's a lot of different strategies throughout the game, but you at least need a little bit of everything to win. I've enjoyed the first edition quite a lot. The second edition, the market adds a little bit more, and it's just been a fun experience throughout the way. That's St. Petersburg.
We played this together once.
Mm-hmm. I played a lot of conventions. It's a convention.
Yeah.
Game.
Yeah. Because it's so out of print.
Yes.
And so I played it the one time. I was like, this is amazing. And you're like, yeah, you can't find this. It's super out of print. I'm like, Oh, okay, never mind. I'm good. But I played it the one time. I had a lot of fun. I would love to play it more, but that's my one experience.
Yeah, I don't even own a copy of this, I don't need to champion this game. It's certainly a classic,
right?
But yeah,
this is a grail game for a lot of Euro.
Oh yeah, yeah. And again, the second edition is kind of funny because it has a lot of tabletop industry people, both publishers and some media people, having their own cards in the game.
Yeah.
So you have Rosenberg, you have Feld, you have a lot of people in the game. Because again, even when the second edition came out, people were already like, that game's a classic. And it was out of print, of course. But now second edition's out of print. I mean, they need to bring that back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I hope so. I would love to play it again.
Absolute classic.
At Kroger Pharmacy, Care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
All right. Next up for me is a game that's very easy to find, very inexpensive. Number 45 is Sprawlopolis. This is from 2018, and it is the first in a long series now from Buttonshy Games of Opolis games. They've done Sprawlopolis, Ugropolis, Natureopolis. I think the new one coming out next year is Casinoopolis. they all have the same basic formula here, designed by Stephen Aramini, Danny Devine, and Paul Kluka. You have 18 cards, which is like the Buttonshy thing, so that's not them, but you have 18 cards. On one side of the card, you have four different blocks of potential city types, in this case for Sprawlopolis. So, if commercial, residential, industrial, and parks and stuff. And then you have, they each have roads on them as well. So you're trying to like lay these out. You're going to have a hand of cards, you play them down, and as you play them down, you're trying to connect the roads and match the patterns or setup of the scoring cards that you start the game with. So of the 18 cards, you're going to set three of them aside because on the flip side is the scoring, right? So one of the scorings might be number of commercial blocks in a single row or column. You're trying to build like one long commercial strip, right? All the blocks in that column or row will be worth 2 points each or whatever they might be. So you have three of those potential scoring mechanisms, and then you have the negative points that you get where you lose points for every unique road in your city. So if you are really slapdash and just throwing like empty dead end roads everywhere, you lose points for that. And some of these cards might also give you negative points. So I've played games of this where I scored -5, and I've played games of this where I scored 52, right? There's no like clean arc of scoring here because the scoring combo is going to be different every time, but it's just a really engaging, fun puzzle that takes up no space. It's a Buttonshy game, so it's like a wallet game. It fits in your pocket. There are multiple expansions. There is a Godzilla for this one, because it is a city-building game. And again, if you don't like the city-building theme, you could do like Agropolis, which is like farming, different types of animals and crops. You could do Natureopolis, which is just like different types of, you know, trees and water and whatever. There's like different themes as well, and they each come with their own little rules. And then the last Kickstarter had a Combopolis where you can combine all three of those together and make like a big mega version. It's fun. It's clever. It's a bit thinkier than you'd expect. It's more or less a single solo player game, but it out of the box, it has rules for two players. So, and that's actually the first time I played it, it's with two players. It's cooperative. So yeah, Sprawlopolis is one of my favorite. In fact, it might be my favorite game to like just carry with me places. It's definitely like anytime I'm going anywhere where I know I'm going to spend time alone, if I'm going to a conference or if I'm going to a convention, if someone's going to leave earlier, I'm going to get there earlier. If I'm going to be on a train or an airplane, I'll bring Sprawlopolis because I know I can get it played. It takes 10 minutes. It's perfect.
It's quite an accomplishment to have so much in such a little game and for it to be, you know, reproduced in different formats across the board. And again, this is a company that has produced so many of these small little Buttonshy games. This is the best version, right? This is the premier version. This is the game.
This is their big game. Yeah, yes. I forgot the numbers on it. I think I talked to them once at a convention, and they're like, "Oh yeah, we've done this much, and Sprawlopolis has done triple that or something."
Sure.
Like, that is their game, and it's the reason why they have a new version of it every like 9 months.
Fantastic. Well, Anthony, quite the opposite here. My number 45 is Rising Sun from 2018. This is from our good friends at CMON. And, of course, the designer Eric Lang and wonderful art by Adrian Smith. This is one of, you know, Eric Lang's big, and I mean big, plastic troops and demons and monsters and spirits and warring clans in Japan fighting each other. But yet at the same time, why this does make my list and has stayed on my list is because of the unique partner option that comes along with this game. So 3 to 5 players are fighting in these legendary mystical feudal Japan. Each player has a clan and they're trying to complete for victory points throughout. So yes, there is military action. Yes, there's troops on the board, but this is a Euro victory point game. Each clan has special abilities and different setups that go along with the game. And then through the game, you are going to be working, you know, creating an alliance with one of the other partners at the table and come up with a plan. So at the start, you're going to pick your cards, you know, pull them, draft them, pull them together. It's going to give you special abilities and opportunities to have different actions. But then this tea ceremony where you get to talk to your partner and be like, hey, look, I think we should do this. Maybe we should mobilize here. Maybe we should attack over here. You know, whatever it might be doing, including betraying your ally there, of course. And then you take a political action just by yourself behind your player board. This is where you can select 1 of 5 different actions on the board because this is an area majority game. You want to control as many areas as possible in order to score the victory points for that particular region. As the game goes on, there is going to be warring. So you're going to be fighting other players, invoking monsters and special abilities throughout, putting new tokens down on the board to claim different areas. Certain areas are going to score each particular round, so there's a fight for those particular areas. This kind of fits that Kemet feel, where you're all forced together. You have some similarities as far as the monsters and troops on the board, but your tactics and your gameplay and your long-term strategy really is up to you. Again, I love the idea of this kind of partner mechanic. If the one thing I will say is people need to take that partnership seriously when they need to stay with it and when they need to break out, because there can be runaway leaders with this game. Certainly not accurate, as the Wikipedia articles would make you believe, but Reinstein's done, it's a lot of fun and a great game to get to the table.
I've played this game a few times. I always enjoy it when I play it. It's not my favorite Eric Lane game. It's not really my favorite of these
sure
types of games. I would put it in like top 200 for me, yeah, which is not bad at all.
Mm-hmm.
I have passed on my copy to someone else, if only because I have so many of these like dudes on a map games.
Of course.
So it's one of those things, like if you brought it down tomorrow and like, let's play Rising Sun, I'm like, great, let's have fun. This is mm-hmm. awesome. I really wanted to keep it just because the miniatures and the aesthetic are so amazing.
Yes.
And I really, really, really did not want to give up that miniature of the character from the Wikipedia hoax, because I bring that into my classroom and I show my students and I'm like, this is why you don't trust Wikipedia.
That's right.
And they always find it funny. But alas, there's other games, which I'll talk about in a couple of weeks.
You mean when you're trying to be historically or mythologically accurate, you shouldn't pull stuff off Wikipedia?
Yeah, because some guy from New Zealand might be pulling a prank on his friend and... Oh, that's so good. So good. All right. Next up for me, I have number 44, another city game, because I told you that's my theme this week. London, second edition. This is from Martin Wallace. And the first edition of London came out back in 2010. And it's fairly similar to the second edition, but they got rid of the map in the second edition, which I think is the best way to play this game for a couple of reasons. One, it's purely a card game in the second edition. Two, it's a much smaller footprint. Three, the artwork kind of blends together more smoothly. That first edition of the game was from Tree Frog Games. It was basically self-published by Martin Wallace. And this is from Osprey Games, which makes some of the most, I don't want to say most beautiful productions. That's not really the right word for it. It's like they look fancy. They look like they belong in a library. Like when Osprey Publishing makes a game, it's like, this should be on a shelf somewhere in the Library of Congress. It's very fair. Fancy looking. The thing about this game that's great, it's a tableau builder, and you are building out a row of different locations in your city. But the thing is like, as you build these out, right, you have to keep in mind the space that they're taking up. Because each slot that you fill will produce negative things for your city, because you have the option at some point to run the city. You don't get the benefits of these cards when you play them. You get it when you run it. And when you run it, you will take on things like pollution and poverty, and like bad things that happen in a city because of industrialism. And so you are trying to be as efficient as possible to run your city at a good cadence, but also, you know, not just keep building out. Like, occasionally you're going to build over. You're going to use that slot. You're going to cover it up with something else because you're like, the old card I had there is no longer needed. I have something new. I'm being efficient with my space to limit the amount of negative stuff I'm taking on. It's a Martin Wallace game, so it's also got loans that you can take. You got to pay this off by the end of the game. And everybody's going to have poverty. That's normal. It's a Martin Wallace game. It's going to be negative points for everybody. But you want to make sure you don't have the most negative points, because it's all the amount of negative points you score is relative to how much everybody else has, right? So it's not like you automatically lose if you have the most, but you score much more negative points if you have more than somebody else. London is great. The artwork's amazing. It's a fun, quick, easy to teach game. Wonderful, like, tableau building type of experience with a very clever spin on it that says something. Not a lot. It's not like a deep, you know, sociological exploration of what it means to industrialize, but it says a little bit, right? More than most games in this vein do. And the production is fantastic from Osprey. So London second edition, just a great game.
Sadly, I've never played this. I've searched for copies of this over the years, because you've mentioned it quite a lot. And yeah, I think there may have only been one time I've had seen this at the table. And it's, as you mentioned, the artwork is stunning. It's a stunning, streamlined, beautiful library piece.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I'll throw it in the bag with Leaving Earth, because it's also a very small box.
Ooh, nice.
So, yeah, Osprey does stuff. It's great. Like, it's very condensed. It's not this big sprawling thing.
And as much as I do like the cover, I have no problems with the cover. I do think the cover is, in fact, what kind of dragged us down a little bit, because yeah, inside the box is beautiful. And it's a Martin Wallace game.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a Martin Wallace game, man.
Yeah, I know. And like, the thing is too, like, the original cover, also not good. It's yeah, like, just goofy looking European dudes with big long hair. I don't like that either. There's got to be like a good way to like showcase the vista that is London,
mm-hmm,
without it being minimalist or maximalist. Like, those are your two options.
they're like, we tried a thing and it didn't work, so we've given up. Just not doing it anymore. Yeah. You're like, oh, come on, man.
Yeah, I don't know. I love it, though. I like that cover is nice to me, but only because I know what's inside.
Well, again, like I said, I mean, Martin Wallace's other most brilliant game of all time, because it's number one on Board Game Geek, Brass Birmingham, right?
Yeah.
And like, look what the production did for that game. Nobody was playing brass. I'm sorry.
I don't care.
Like, I've played the original version, and I know I met one person in all my years who's been like, I like the original version, and I checked his temperature just in case. But like, beyond that, like, if they would just do a little bit more, this certainly would be up there.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's a shame. I wish it was up. It came out the year before Brass Birmingham, and mm-hmm, it kind of faded away. Australia was in there too. Like, these games that just kind of like didn't have the impact.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll get another printing at some time. I don't know.
All right. For me, Anthony, this is my controversial pick. My number 44 is Terraforming Mars Ares Expedition for 2021. Maybe I should not say more about why it's controversial, but
I think we can guess.
You might want to guess. If you can guess, if you listen to the podcast, you already know. But I love Terraforming Mars. I've loved Terraforming Mars since it came out. It's one of my most played games of all time. And I've had so many wonderful experiences with Terraforming Mars. There's been some challenging experiences with Terraforming Mars, mostly around the production of the original game. They have since corrected it, and then I think overcorrected, but we're not talking about big box editions. We promise we wouldn't say that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But the main problems of the game was, at least in the playing of it, the deck was too big with all the expansions. And oftentimes, you would kind of get this watered-down experience of Terraforming Mars. And if you got lucky, you got something good, a good experience. but oftentimes, more often than not, and I play this on Board Game Arena a lot, and I'm just like, I'll play it solo on Board Game Arena and just go and look at my original hand of 10 cards. I'm like, I'm not playing this. Like, if I can't do something with the original 10 cards, I'm not playing this. So the deck issues, along with the graphic design issues, along with the, you know, the art issues, because really what Terraforming Mars comes down to, it's a tableau builder. I don't think I have to talk too much about Terraforming Mars. It's Terraforming Mars. It's utilizing your corporation's special ability to enhance the different cards that were Terraforming Mars. Some of its plants, some of its animals, some of its buildings and cities, some of its waters and oceans and plants and raising the temperature. Everything is good, except everything about the production and, again, the deck mechanics. So when Terraforming Mars Ares Expedition came along, I was like, what is this? What could this be? Well, it happens to be a brilliant, streamlined version of Terraforming Mars with outrageously good graphic design, solid artwork across the board that's unified. You're not getting wacky different clip art pictures throughout and royalty-free stuff. And it just plays Terraforming well so much better, right? It focuses on what it needs to focus on, which is the tableau building. It shrinks Mars down as far as like the action spots and things you're actually going to take, but it plays so very smooth, and it utilizes the main mechanics from Race for the Galaxy, which again is a brilliant game and a brilliant mechanic. You're basically picking the phases that you want to play for that particular round. You're playing out those phases. The cards match those particular phases, so everything is streamlined and understandable. It's quick to play. It's quicker to play than Terraforming Mars, but it's longer. It's more of an enriching experience than Race for the Galaxy. So, again, you have to listen to the rest of the episodes, but Terraforming Mars, Ares Expedition, fantastic game, and it is my number 44.
All right. I will hold on comments, but not for the reason you're all thinking.
Oh,
so, I know. I'm sorry.
I was excited there for a minute.
I know. I wish.
Yeah.
All right. Next up for me, I have number 43. This is, I think, and I'm looking at my list, but I believe this is my highest ranked Bethala Cerda game. The Gallerist. And The Gallerist is a game that I fell in love with immediately before I really knew who Bethala Cerda was. And there's a few reasons why. The first is just it's a beautiful game, right? It's the first Bethala Cerda Ian O'Toole joint that I saw. I think it might have been the first one that they published. If not this, it was Vinos. But it was very early on, like 2015, this came out. But even beyond that, it was the first time I saw like this idea of like theme being such a core concept in a really heavy Euro game. And yet, despite saying really heavy Euro game, The Gallerist is, in my opinion, the simplest Vitalis Herita game. It doesn't say much. They're all very heavy. But I have taught this game to people in 15 minutes because there are only 8 actions on the board. They're all very visible. Like you're moving your pawn around this rondel and taking actions. There's only 4 spots you can go. And in each of those spots, there's only 2 actions you can take, right? You move your pawn. If there's a pawn already there, you bump them out. They leave an assistant. And that assistant gets bumped down for like a follow action. Cause that's the thing Lacerda likes to do. And then you take that action. And those actions are very thematic. So it's very easy to follow what you're supposed to be doing, right? You are recruiting artists or putting art on display or selling it. It's all very thematic. Like you look at the board and compared to a lot of Lacerda boards, this one, like if you've never played it, it doesn't necessarily make sense, but it's very quick and easy to explain what you're looking at, right? There are people who will come to the gallery and look at the art. And as they look at the art or purchase the art, the fame of that artist will increase, which increases the value of that art. And you can choose when you're going to sell that art based on the value of that art. And then the points kind of follow from there based on the fame that's built in. It's such a cool, interesting take on a fairly familiar Euro mechanic. This is not Lacerda at his most like experimental. It's him at his most like, let's take what we know about Euro games and about, you know, economic engine type of games and like build it into the system that is so finely tuned to the theme, right? Vinos did that really well. I think the Gallerist takes that to a whole nother level. Now, I'm not going to argue, like I talked about Lisboa a few weeks ago, I'm not going to argue that he doesn't have like more complex, interesting, broader experiences. Like, I think Lisboa might be, it is, I don't want to say might be, it is a better game. I think On Mars, it is a better game, but the Gallerist is my favorite game because of how accessible it is and how cleanly it does all the things that Lacerda does in his designs. Plus, you have like all the artwork that comes from like, you know, just it's real world art. Mm-hmm. It's built into the game, which is so fantastic. The little easels and everything. So yeah, the Gallerist, it's every time I get this to the table, it just puts a big smile on my face. It's such a wonderful, wonderful production. And we wouldn't have any of the other big Lacerda big box things if we didn't have this one. So
I think, again, like I would define it more as like his most streamlined game.
Yeah.
Just because it's still got a 4.24 weight on Board Game Geek.
That feels too high.
Because it's so streamlined. I don't think it's necessarily simple. It's his simplest game. I mean, it's not simple, of course, but like
no. Escape Plan's the simplest. Well, yeah.
Other smaller throwaways here and there
too. Yeah, like things that he's worked on with other people.
Sure.
Like of the big box Eagle Griffin games, this is like the second lowest for me in terms of complexity.
Sure.
It is still a very complicated game. Don't get me wrong. Like, don't go out there being like, I have a light Lacerda. It's not a light Lacerda.
That man doesn't do light. He doesn't do light.
If you're teaching a game to somebody who knows games, I'm telling you, you can teach this game in like 15 minutes. Sure. It's not that complicated. And the board makes sense. Like it's up there with Kanban in terms of like, once you look at the board and somebody walks you through it, mm-hmm. everything there makes sense.
Yes.
It all flows. It has this, the board is telling a story
yes.
that you can follow in ways that even as like Lisboa is amazing. I don't think the board does that. This one does that.
Okay. All right. I give it. I think I'm going to take a broad jump here, Anthony, here. I think the thing you and I appreciate most about tabletop gaming or designs, I should say designs, is the thematic gameplay that just makes sense, right? It flows, right. It follows.
Yeah.
And I think that surprisingly is very difficult. And so many games are mechanics or theme.
Yeah.
And I think there are very few games that utilize the theme to teach the mechanics and the mechanics play into the theme. Like it just... it's a beautiful symphony. He does amazing work. So this didn't make my top 100, but like it certainly was in like my top 105.
Sure.
For sure. Cause there's other ones that are a little bit higher for me, but I absolutely 100% agree with you on this. All right. My number 43 was a game that Anthony talked about recently. I mean, really recently, like, you'll have to listen to it, but like last week they talked about this. This is Obsession from 2018. And I don't know how much more I could say about this. And again, you should listen to Anthony's review on this, but I will say that I'm uniquely qualified to talk about this game because in real time after playing this game, I was obsessed with it.
Yeah, you were.
And Anthony can vouch for it.
Yeah, I was like, dude, let's go.
I was playing another game. I don't remember what the other game was that I was playing, that we were playing. We were playing another game. Which one was it, Ant? Do you remember?
It was some random game. It was not one of like the four that we took away from that weekend. It was something random.
It wasn't the giant, it wasn't Barrage?
No.
Because that was a nightmare of a teach. Because
it was just something at the next table over. I don't remember what it was. It's very forgettable.
So I played Obsession. And again, I liked it. I liked Obsession so much. And I picked up on the gameplay so quickly and I learned the game. And as we went through our, you know, the next couple of days at the convention at PAX Unplugged in Philly, every time I got a chance to see someone else playing it, I would pop in and go, do you have any questions? because I could answer all your questions. Yes, I've only played it once or I think once or twice at that point. I could answer any questions. I could teach you this game. You want me to teach you this game? I could teach you this game. And then Anthony's like, could you just come back to our table? I'm like, no. I have to. They have to know about Obsession. They need to know, man. They need to know. They need the hit. So long before this was the big game, I think it just sat on the table almost randomly.
Yeah.
And Dan Halligan, both the designer and the artist and the publisher here. And we've talked about him before because his wonderfulness to actually make the expansions affordable and to think about people and to release, you know, errata and other corrections and such along the way and provide endless amounts of support has been wonderful. I knew nothing about the man. I knew nothing about anything about his stuff until I played the game. If you not have played Obsession, stay away from me. I will teach you this game, whether you like it or not. So I am not in at all into the whole Victorian upstairs, downstairs, and all of that other kind of genre stuff that comes along with it. There's just something so compelling about this game. And certainly the mechanics do make a lot of sense, right? You start out with a family. That's your family. And you're trying to grow prestige in your family with the, you know, the royals, the rich people out there, the aristocracy. And each of your family members have special abilities. They have pluses and sometimes they even have minuses. And you'll be able to play those cards for your hand to be able to activate different things on the board. Primarily, you're trying to build up your estate with these different rooms that will allow you to get resources, build up prestige, and primarily score victory points at the game because your estate is so wonderful, has so many wonderful parties. And in order to employ all of these different members of your family, you are going to need the servants of your house to be able to activate those cards, activate the different rooms. They have to be there to actually be able to do those events when people are coming to visit. And it allows you to purchase new cards to add to your family, to add to that draw of people who are going to be attending. Again, some are better, some are worse. There's a particular track that runs along that shows you all the different occasions and activities and events. And of course, you're trying to sway the most powerful, popular people out there. It's a brilliant, brilliant game. It's a lot of fun. And I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of games that when we talk about independent designers and publishers and artists and just like being just wonderful and spectacular, this is one of the best. So Obsession, for so many different reasons, is my number 43.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I talked about it at length last week. I 100% agree. It is my number 56 for all those reasons and more.
Absolutely. But you're not obsessed with it, Anthony. You need to be obsessed with it.
I'm 56, man. It's number 56.
All right. But see, Obsession kicks in at 43. I'm just saying. Yeah.
Okay. Well, then my number 42, I am obsessed with.
All right. There you go.
this is Rebuilding Seattle. Mm-hmm. This came out last year. We played it at PAX 2 years ago, actually. Crazy, time flies. And this is a game about rebuilding Seattle. It takes place after the Great Fire of 1889 that burned down most of downtown Seattle, back when Seattle was kind of a frontier town. And you are basically every round you're going to take a card and you're going to play polyominoes down into your tableau based on the card that you took. You're going to pay whatever amount that is. Some of the cards will just give you straight polyominoes that like move you up on these different tracks and increase your values for different types of production. And some of them will just give you like in-game scoring bonuses, all sorts of things, right? If you get enough money, you can put out some of your like monument things, which are Seattle landmarks. The only one that has a real name on it is the Space Needle. They don't have, I guess, the IP rights to the things actually in Seattle. So, like, you have Indoor Mall, which is Westlake Center. You have several other, like, Outdoor Market, which is Pike Place Market. You have Stadium, which is Safeco Field, or T-Mobile Park. It's funny. Like, I'm from Seattle, so I recognize everything that they've put into the game. And I love the theming of it because it's not just like pictures of the city. Those are really just on the monument cards. it's like you each have your own personal player board that represents a neighborhood in the city, and each of those has different laws that are asymmetrical, and you can use one of those laws every round. So like some of them are more education focused if you're like in the university district, some are more commerce focused if you're downtown. The tableaus themselves are going to change and, you know, expand and evolve over the course of the game. You have like all these different tiles you're going to put out to kind of like basically you can't put the polyominoes down unless you have the building tiles in which to place them. And so you need to get those tiles, and how you get those tiles will vary depending on your strategy. And the most interesting part of the game is the event cards, which are laid out at the beginning of every round, and they each have a scoring mechanism on them. Anybody can take them whenever they want as their action. So you never know how long the round is going to be. Like, you all could just keep going and spending your money until you all run out and then pull the event cards. Or somebody could rush it and say, you know what? We're scoring orange. Now we're scoring pink. And now we're scoring blue. Guess what? The round's almost over. Because I'm ahead and I just want to rush this. It's such a like engaging, interesting back and forth. The game is relatively quick. It's very easy to teach. The solo experience is fantastic as well. Like, I gravitated towards it because it was something, something Seattle. And I'm always interested in games about where I'm from. But in the end, it was like a really, really good polyomino puzzle-based tableau building game. It does everything so cleverly. I thought I'd like it because of the theme. I didn't think it would jump into my top 50, but here it is.
Wow.
So, Rebuilding Seattle.
That being said, Anthony, I'm more obsessed with this game, and it's higher on my list.
Well, you know what?
It's just that I love Seattle a lot more than you. That's all I'm saying, man.
All right.
You're cool. You're kind of like Seattle, but not obsessed like I am, man.
Next time you're there, bring me back a hat.
I'm there all the time. Mm-hmm. That's definitely going to happen really soon.
Hats, man. Hats. Give me hats.
All right. My number 42 is a game that we played way back in the day. We reviewed way back in the day. It's one of our most popular episodes that we talked about in a Versus back in 2009. And again, it's mostly new incarnation in 2024. Cyclades. Cyclades is a game that I played back in 2009. Loved it. This was a game that just meant so much to me because Anthony talked a little bit about his history. When I came into tabletop gaming, the vibe or the experience that I was really looking for was kind of experienced with was Risk. I love the idea of troops on a map, area control, battling out for supremacy with a number of different players. And I had always been looking for that type of experience, but on a more dynamic level. And when I stumbled across Cyclades, which was ancient Greek mythology from Bruno Cathala and Ludovic Mabanc, and it's all about, using all the resources that you have of your particular isle, of your troops, your ships, your civilization, to build up resources to plead with the gods in order to support you in your different aspects to build up these metropolises by allowing you to move between the islands. So you need Poseidon's help to build up navies, to travel to different areas, to build ports. You need Zeus to hire priests and build temples. You need Athena to provide her worshippers with philosophers and universities. And of course, you always need Apollo because you need income throughout the game. But now comes in Ares because you're going to fight. This is a battling game. This is troops on the map, but you have all of the wonderful mythology from the time. You have all the monsters and creatures and all the heroes and heroines that are coming to your aid. So there's a lot of different markets and tableau building throughout. And it's just a crush of different military functions that really comes down to, once again, euro mechanics. You have to build up an economy in order to be able to sway the gods to your favor because there's a bidding mechanism for those gods. You just don't throw money at them. You have to throw the most money at them in order to get them on your side for that particular round. So it allows you to take different actions based upon which gods you are able to go along with, which, you know, as far as bidding is concerned, there's been a bunch of different expansions. All of the expansions makes the game better. It allows you to do more things at one time. The base game is good. But with the expansions, it's better. It allows you to, you know, has artifacts and other gods come into play. There's a Titans standalone expansion game that you can play that kind of shrinks the islands to more of a battle arena. And there's the new edition that, you know, was recently crowdfunded that just revamps everything. I already have enough of the base stuff, and I love it so much. It's the brother or sister to Kemet, and both great games. Cyclades is certainly up there for me. Yeah, it's beautiful production, beautiful artwork, great game, number 42 for me.
I remember this episode. We've recorded a lot of episodes, right? We were 496 right now.
Yeah.
I do not actively remember every episode we recorded.
Wow.
Like, there's some, it's like, we were on the moon this episode, I'm sure, whatever.
I remember that episode.
But I have a very vivid memory of recording Kemet versus Cyclades.
Yeah.
And like the legit real feelings in that room, specifically between you and Daniel over these two games.
Yeah.
And I feel like since that day, Cyclades has been on your top 100, like almost just out of like, I have to do this. Like, I have to defend this game.
It's a great game.
It's a great, if you want to listen to one of the all time great conversations on Board Gamers Anonymous, check out episode 35. Right around the 45 minute mark. It was great. Cyclades is fun. One of the best auction mechanics in a game. But also a very good episode of our show.
And the new production is just, take a look at the miniatures in the new production. They're gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. Yeah. It's Miguel Coimbra for the artwork there. And it took every ounce of my restraint to not back it. It's just beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. No, good stuff. All right. Last one for me this week. Number 41 is a game that just came out this year, like back in January. Sankore, the Pride of Mansa Musa.
Mm.
This is a game about building a university in Timbuktu in the 14th century. And it is designed by Fabio Lupiano, working with Mandela Fernandez Grandin. This is the heaviest game Lupiano has made by like a country mile. Lupiano is really known for making like solid, condensed, interesting Euro games that take like less than 90 minutes. Mansa Musa is a 2.5 to 3.5 hour game. It's a big one. It's chunky. But it works, right? Working again with Ian O'Toole and Osprey Games, so it's just an absolutely beautiful production. Right up there with Merv, but there's more stuff going on. And it requires you to really keep track of a lot of different things, right? There are multiple different areas of the board that you're interacting with that represent the different kind of schools within this college, this university that you're building. So you need to enroll pupils, you need to graduate those pupils, you need to teach the classes that they're in, you need to add to your curriculum, you need to fill the library with books, you need to go out and find knowledge. There are multiple different disciplines you have to keep track of: theology, law, mathematics, astronomy. There's a map in which you're going out and collecting different things and building elements of it. There's a construction component where you're placing tiles down. And those tiles come from both your actions and the actions you take in other sections of the map. Thematically, the game is a little sketchy. Like, it could be different things. There's a lot of just like, go here, move this tile, move this tile, move this tile, move this tile. But the more I play it, the more it kind of comes together. And it really does start to feel like you're building this university in the sense that everything is kind of abstract and it's hard to understand what you're trying to accomplish until you accomplish it, which is very much like working in a university. And it's just this beautiful, complex Euro that the sum of its parts is greater than any one individual part. I've always really enjoyed Lupiano's games. They've never really risen quite to like this level for me. Like, I love Ragusa. I love Merv. There's a lot of games of his that just work on a lot of levels. Like, I have Merv in my top 100. It's number 89 for me. We talked about it a few weeks ago, but this one, like, immediately the first time I played it, I'm like, oh, this is something more. This is a little more complex. This is a little more interesting. More time has gone into this game. It was expensive, and there's a lot going on here. It took a little bit of time to learn, but it's up there as one of the more dynamic, interactive Euros that Lupiano's made and that I played in the last couple of years. Like, it's not playing it safe, which is, I think, what we get a lot now from a lot of these Euro games that are coming out. It's doing interesting, new, different things. And it's still like tight, limited resources, limited actions, like you'd expect from a Lopiano game, but in a much bigger, sprawling map with a lot of different actions and options for what you're going to do. So, Sankore, the Pride of Monte Musa. Great game.
Yeah, my only experience of this game is I had seen it at a game convention, and I took a picture of it, and I sent it to you, and I'm like, this? And you're like, yeah, this. And I'm like, oh, this. But I have not played it yet.
It's pretty, but it's also just a lot of bits all over the map. I feel like you can look at it and be like, what is that? Like it doesn't look like what it is, but once you play it, it all comes together.
Need to play this then. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, you do, for sure. I think you'd like it.
All right, my last game here is my number 41. It's a game some people have heard about. It's recently got a reproduction, super deluxe fancy version. It's a game by a newer game designer, Stefan Feld something. This is The Castle's Burgundy. This is a game that you probably know quite well. You've probably played.
I know this. I know it.
He does. See? You all know right?
I know it.
But the people listening, Anthony, do they know about The Castle's Burgundy?
I hope so.
At this point, right? You're like, seriously, people, Castle's Burgundy. Yeah, so The Castle's Burgundy, Stefan Feld's kind of... It's the quintessential point salad Stefan Feld game. If you talk about Stefan Feld, you're probably talking about The Castles of Burgundy. I don't know what to say about this that hasn't been said yet at this point. The game is set in Burgundy, in a region in medieval France, and each player is taking the role of an aristocrat, because that's typically what Stefan Feld does a lot. And you're building settlements and castles, and you're trading resources, you know, with the ports. Now, all of that description is nonsensical, right? Because it's like, yeah, that's typically what the game is. But really what it comes down to is two primary boards. You have your own particular, you know, region of Burgundy here. And it is made up of all of these different hexes of different colors. Now, each of these hexes of a particular color relate to something specific. So the blue hexes relate to the ships, the beige brown buildings, you know, the action buildings are on your board. The gold buildings are going to be your victory points or your special abilities. Your light greens are going to be for the animals on your farms. Your silvers are for your silver mines. And your dark, rich forest greens are going to be your castle locations. And you're going to roll your dice each turn, and you're going to determine where on the main board you might want to select new hex buildings to put on your particular Burgundy board. So use the dice to select off that board onto your reserve. And then you also are able to utilize those dice to take them off your reserve, off one of the three spots, onto your main board. There's an endless number of special abilities that come into play. There's a lot of ways to score points. You want to complete sections of a particular color as early as possible to gain bonus points throughout the game. And there is a real fight for the market in order to get the resources that you need and the particular buildings that you need in order to score. Typically based upon the yellow buildings, but you can score endless amounts of points without even purchasing a yellow building. This is a point salad game. A lot of ways to score points. That track is constantly rising up. And it really offers really strong, dynamic, competitive play throughout. One of the best Euros out there, The Castles of Burgundy by Stefan Feld.
I agree. I agree so much. In fact, I'm so obsessed with this game that we'll talk about it not next week, but in the future.
You brought it back, man.
I did.
All right, so everyone, that's everything for this week. Hopefully you enjoyed our 50 to 41 in our top 100. Next week, no surprise, top 100 games of all time, 40 to 31, unless Anthony throws a major wrench and we do some random episode, which...
Ooh, let's do it.
Which I'm trying to get him not to do, people.
It's the second time it's come up. We got to do it.
But before we kind of sign off for this particular episode, I did want to mention... Some things that we've been talking about. I've been trying to get as many of you as possible. We have 10,000 plus listeners each and every week, and we have a little bit less than 1,000 people subscribed on YouTube. We talked about our contest, 100 games out to our listeners out there. But the main reason why we're doing this is because we are going to have, and this is something we haven't done in quite some time, but in our top 100 series, the top 10 games, Anthony and I are going to be on a live feed on YouTube so that you can actually join us for that last 10, talk with us as we go through these games and record the actual podcast. So it's going to be something a little fun. Maybe, in fact, something we might continue to do in the future. But we want you to join us at the table on YouTube for our final 10 games of our top 100 games of all time. So please, if you haven't already, subscribe, because you want to get those notifications of when those episodes come up. And it does a great deal to support the podcast by doing something as simple as subscribing and giving a like, thumbs up.
It's going to be fun. It will be live. We're going to be all clean and dressed.
And remember, Anthony put War of the Ring in his Hall of Fame game, so that will not be his number one game.
It will not. No one's going to guess what my number one
it's
is.
It's historic. I don't know.
Yeah, you can't guess. You're not going to guess. No one's going to guess. It's going to be great.
Oh, no. Is it Obsession?
Nope. That was on my list last week.
All right. I was just checking.
That would really throw people off.
Well, that's how obsessed you are with it, that you would put it on your list twice.
Just kidding. It's not number 54. Number 54 is actually this game. It's my number one.
So you definitely want to tune in for that, to see a historic moment in our 11 years of podcasting, that there's actually a new number one for Anthony. It's been done. I know. It's going to be here. You're going to be live for it. And we want you to join us at the table. We hope that you're all having a great day listening. Have a great week. And we'll talk to you next week. So until next time, this is Chris.
And this is Anthony.
And we'll see you all a seat at the table. Take care, everyone.
Bye.
For you, would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top tier equipment for $15 a month, plus save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.